Please rise. Superior Court resumes its session. The Honorable William Morse presiding.
Be seated, please. Your next witness.
You walk there, Jack.
Ma'am, if you come up to the witness stand, please.
And if you'd remain standing and raise your right hand. You solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you'll give now before this court will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I do.
Thank you. You may be seated. And for the record, please state your name, spelling both first and last name.
My name is Jackie Haig, J-A-C-K-I-E-H-A-E-G.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
Did you ever remember our first attorney, Brent Cole, saying anything about the governor in regard to my case?
He said it was
objection, hearsay.
If I'm recalling, there was a question asked of Cole about whether Murkowski gave instructions to set an example. So if that's what you're referring to, this is potentially a prior inconsistent statement. So go ahead.
Is it true that Mr. Cole told us that Alaska's Governor Murkowski...
Ask her non-leading question. So ask okay. her, what did Cole say about
What do you
Murkowski?
Remember Cole saying about the governor?
He said that this was such a big case that the governor would probably be wanting to make an example of you.
Okay. Did he ever say anything about calling my prosecutor or judge?
I can't remember that.
Okay. Do you remember, did Mr. Cole ever lead us to believe I had a plea agreement?
Yes, he did.
And as far as you know, what did that plea agreement entail?
You were going to go out to McGrath and be able to plead open sentence, and the airplane, the judge would determine whether or not you could get your airplane back. I don't remember all of the... How many years?
Okay. Was that agreement that he talked or... is it your understanding that I could be sentenced to a one-year suspension or guide license?
Yes.
Okay. Do you remember Mr. Cole telling us to give up guiding in reliance on this... did Mr. Cole ever tell us to give up guiding?
He said that it would look good if you did not guide.
Okay. Did he ever tell us that... The prosecutor, Scott Leaders, agreed to give us credit if we didn't?
Yes.
Okay. Did we give up guiding for that plea agreement?
Yes, we did.
Did we also fly in witnesses from as far away as Illinois on the eve of going out to be sentenced?
Yes.
Did we ever make that plea agreement?
What do you mean?
Did we ever finalize it?
Did we ever go out? No.
Okay, and why was that?
Because when we got to the office...
In whose office?
Mr. Cole's office. Mr. Cole came in and he said, you know, I have bad news. Prosecutor Leaders has changed the plea agreement. We're not going to be able to go out to McGrath tomorrow.
Did Mr. Cole say he could do anything to get the other agreement back?
He told you, or he told all of us, that the only thing he could do would be to contact Leader's boss because she was a woman that he had worked with in the past.
Did he ever say anything about not wanting to piss off the prosecutor because he had to make deals with him in the future?
Yes.
Is it correct we went to Anchorage on November 8th, 2004 with the intent of flying to McGrath on November 9th, 2004?
Yes.
Okay. On the night of, was I arraigned telephonically on the 9th rather than going out to McGrath? Did we do a telephonic thing with the court?
Yes.
Okay. After that, on the night of November 9th, what was the mood of everybody, all the witnesses, Cole included, on the night of November 9th?
Everybody was upset we didn't go out there to McGrath.
And was everybody, including Mr. Cole, extremely angry about what Mr. Leaders had done?
Yes.
And so if Mr. Cole has testified under oath that everybody was ecstatic, that would not be true.
That wouldn't be true.
Okay. You ever hear Mr. Robinson, or did we ever ask Mr. Robinson about enforcing the plea agreement?
Yes.
And what did Mr. Robinson say?
He couldn't do anything. It was, I think his term was water under the bridge.
Okay, and you were there personally when Mr. Robinson said that?
Yes, I remember saying that, yes.
Did Mr. Robinson say anything about how Cole had represented me? I guess, did Mr. Robinson say something about, I don't know how to make this not leading, but about Brent Cole lying to me? Did we talk about Brent Cole lying to me with Mr. Robinson?
I don't remember that.
Okay. Do you ever remember Mr. Robinson saying, even if Cole was lying to me, it might not be ineffective assistance of counsel?
Oh, I remember that, yes. We were in a meeting with him.
Okay.
Robinson.
Yeah. And so what Robinson had said is even if Mr. Cole had lied to me about the plea agreement, it might not have meant that I got ineffective assistance of counsel.
That's what I understood, yes.
Okay. Did Mr. Robinson in other words, Mr. Robinson said he couldn't enforce any deal I had with Cole. Did you ever hear Mr. Robinson say something about a defense called subject matter jurisdiction?
Yeah, I remember.
Objection, relevance. Mr. Robinson's already testified to all of this.
Okay.
It's still relevant. I'm not sure why we're going over it again.
Okay. Did Mr. Robinson ever say if I brought up other defenses, this may waive subject matter jurisdiction or admit it? He said waive. Anyway.
I remember hearing that.
Okay. Did you attend my trial in McGrath?
I did.
And would those dates include 5-17-05, 5-18-05, 7-25-05, 7-26-05, 7-27-05, 7-28-05, and 7-29-05?
That sounds correct, yes.
So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days. Is it true trial went to nearly midnight some days?
Yes.
Were you present in the courthouse every hour of trial?
I was, yes.
Were you also in McGrath at the courthouse during my sentencing? Or were you in McGrath for my sentencing?
Yes, I was in McGrath.
Okay. Is it true Judge Murphy lived in Antioch and flew with us on the same plane to McGrath?
Yes.
And can you explain how that happened? I mean, where we got on, where she got on?
We got on in Anchorage. We would fly to Antioch, pick up the people in Antioch, and then go back to McGrath. And everybody that was going to McGrath would get off the plane there.
Is it true that Judge Murphy lived in Antioch and so... At first, we got on the plane in Anchorage, flew down without Judge Murphy, but picked her up in McGrath, in Antioch, and then we all went to McGrath.
Yes, okay. We'd pick her up in Antioch.
And when we got off the plane, where did Judge Murphy go?
She went right over to the truck with Trooper Gibbons.
And that happened more than once when we arrived?
Yes.
Okay. Did we usually travel to McGrath with Mr. Robinson?
Yes.
Would he have seen Judge Murphy get in with Trooper Gibbons?
Yes.
During my trial, how often did you see
I have a question. Did this, was there a single flight from, the Anchorage, Antioch to McGrath?
Yes.
So there was one time when Murphy departed the McGrath airport with the trooper. And there was only one flight, right?
I believe
the trial got split
than,
into.
It's his, her question. It's her,
I believe
he's
there
the witness.
Was more than one flight, yes.
How many times did you fly with Murphy to McGrath?
I think it was two times.
Two times?
I think so.
And you, how many times did she go with the trooper?
Each time.
Okay.
During my trial, you testified you're at the courthouse. How often did you see Judge Murphy riding around with Trooper Gibbons?
Anytime she left the courthouse, she would get in the truck with him, with Trooper Gibbons.
Okay, and did they arrive together also at the courthouse?
At times that we would see her arrive also, yes.
Okay, and did this riding around together during trial, did this include breaks, lunch, and dinner?
Yes.
And because, is it true that trial went so late, midnight, that actually we would leave to go eat dinner sometimes somewhere else?
Correct.
And come back to go till midnight. And then at every day of, is it true that when Judge Murphy left, at the end of each day, she left with Judge Murphy also? Or, I mean, left with Trooper Gibbons?
Correct.
Okay. Did you ever see Judge Murphy and Trooper Gibbons eat together?
We would eat at the, there was a hotel that was right at the airport, and we would have our meals there. And there was times that Judge Murphy was in there and Trooper Gibbons was sitting at the table with her. Yes.
Okay. And do you remember the name of that place?
I can't remember.
Could it have been the McGrath B&B?
It could have been, yes.
Okay. And did we stay at the McGrath B&B with Judge Murphy?
We did.
Okay. Is it true that Robinson smoked?
Yes, he smoked.
Would we sometimes go outside the courthouse while he smoked?
Any break they let us have, he would go outside and be with us and smoke, yes.
And at that time when you were with Robinson, did you ever see Judge Murphy get in the truck with Trooper Gibbons?
When we would go on break, yes, she would leave with Trooper Gibbons.
Okay. Just taking an estimate, how many times do you think you've seen Judge Murphy riding around with Trooper Gibbons during my trial alone?
I don't
just
know.
A guesstimate.
If there was, I don't know, how many days did you say?
Well, and the arriving, so.
Maybe 10.
Okay.
Or more.
Well, I mean, if they arrived in the morning, maybe left for lunch and dinner, and then came back, and then left after court was done. I guess I'll put it this way. Did you ever see Judge Murphy arrive or leave the courthouse alone or with anyone other than Trooper Gibbons?
No.
And so based on that, would it be true that she would arrive there, that would be one ride in the morning, she would leave at least probably at noon for another ride, probably for dinner, and then leave after court was over. So would it be fair to say that there's at least four times, if not more, because of breaks, that she was running around with Trooper Gibbons per day?
Yeah.
Okay. And if you took that four times the 7 days of trial alone, four times seven is?
28.
So probably over 20 rides with?
It could have been over 20 rides.
Okay. Did I ever complain to Mr. Robinson about Trooper Gibbons giving Judge Murphy rides?
Yes, you did.
And what did Chuck Robinson say?
Basically said, this is the way it is in the village. There's nothing you can do about it.
Okay. How how often were you, were you physically with Mr. Robinson most of the time you seen the rides taking place?
Yes.
And that's because we walked to court with him, walked away from court with him, went on breaks with him. Basically, we were with,
with him all the time.
Yeah, because none of us had a house there. We stayed in the same place. So.
Yes.
Okay.
We rented a house together.
In other words, Mr. Robinson must have seen Trooper Gibbons giving Judge Murphy rides almost, if not more, I mean, almost as many times as you did.
Objection. She couldn't possibly know that.
Overrule.
Yes, I believe that.
Did you ever hear the tape recordings of my prosecution capturing Judge Murphy and Trooper Gibbons joking about the rides Trooper Gibbons was giving Judge Murphy?
Yes, I heard that.
Who was on this tape?
It was Judge Murphy. They were going on break, and Judge Murphy said to Trooper Gibbons that I believe she was out of Coca-Cola and wanted to commandeer him to take her to the store.
And in that same recording, in fact, didn't Judge Murphy
say...
Where
did you hear this? Who recorded this?
The state did. It was the court recording.
Sorry?
It was the court recording of the proceedings. I believe I was transcribing them when I heard it.
Well, it was... The state transcribed it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was listening to the tapes.
No. How adamant was I that Mr. Cole testify at my sentencing?
You wanted him there. We got a hotel room for him. We bought tickets for him, and you told Chuck Robinson that you wanted him there.
And is the reason why I wanted him there is I wanted to get credit for the year of guiding that we gave up.
Yes.
Was there any question at all that Mr. Robinson was going to subpoena and question Mr. Cole about that under oath at my sentencing?
No.
Did Mr. Cole ever testify at my sentencing?
No.
Did he ever show up in McGrath? Did you ever hear me ask Mr. Robinson what could be done about that?
I don't remember that.
Okay. When I was on appeal, did you find anything wrong with the court record?
We went into the Kenai court to look at the record, and I found a cover letter that Mr. Cole had stated that Dave had written up a letter to the court explaining why he had done what he did, and the cover letter was in the court record, but the whole letter wasn't there.
And so is it your opinion that the court record itself was tampered with to remove my evidence?
It was gone.
And the proof that it was in there and properly admitted is the cover letter which remained in the court record?
Correct.
And is that letter, as far as you know, was that letter the evidence I had that I was killing the wolves where the state told me to?
Yes, you said that in the letter.
Okay. And so to sum this up, my evidence was corruptly removed out of the official court record.
Your evidence was gone, yes.
Did we ever go back out to McGrath after we had fired Chuck Robinson?
I don't remember going back out there.
You remember a friend of ours, Greg Pearson, and we went out and I started representing
yes,
myself.
Yes,
that
yes. sorry, yes, we went out and you talked to Magistrate Woodmansey.
And is it true we went out there for a quote-unquote representation hearing for me to start representing myself?
Yes, that's correct.
And at that hearing, who was there?
Magistrate Woodmansey and Trooper Gibbons. You were there, I was there, and Greg Pearson was there.
Okay, do you remember how long this lasted?
I think it was a couple days.
Okay, well, it's true, I don't know. It's true we were there a couple days because there's only one flight, so we whatever. And anyway, I guess we can move on with that. Did you hear at the end of that hearing, did you hear Mr. Woodman or Magistrate Woodmansey say anything?
Yeah, I believe we were going on a break, maybe to lunch or dinner, and he asked Trooper Gibbons if he could give him a ride, and Trooper Gibbons said something to the effect that, no, I can't do that because of what happened the last time. And I believe he meant.
I'm going to object to hearsay. Trooper Gibbons or Magistrate Woodmansey could both come and testify at the contents of their conversation.
Sustained.
And I'll just point out, Magistrate Woodmansey's now dead, so he's not available. But.
Still sustained.
Okay. Has anyone, no, I guess we don't need to do that. That's all I have.
Cross.
So, Mrs. Haig, you testified that you heard on the record the court asked about getting a Diet Coke from the trooper, right? Or
yeah.
Say that she was going to commandeer his vehicle to get a Diet Coke, right?
She wanted him to take her to the store. Mm-hmm. I did hear that, yes.
And then when they came back on the record, she explained that no ex parte communication occurred.
I don't remember that.
You don't remember that?
I don't remember that, no.
Okay. Are you aware that she filed an affidavit in this matter stating that the only ride that she ever received from Trooper Gibbons was after the sentencing because it was late at night?
Yes, I'm
McGrath?
Aware of that. I am aware of that, yes.
Now, this has been, just the PCR alone is almost 10 years old now, right?
Correct.
And fair to say it has significantly impacted your life?
That's fair to say, yes.
You want it to be resolved favorably in your husband's favor, right?
I want it to be resolved, no matter what.
Okay. Preferably but favorably in his favor?
Of course.
Okay. Could you describe Sergeant Matt Dobson, wildlife trooper, describe his appearance?
I don't know who he is.
You didn't see another trooper in McGrath during this trial?
I don't remember seeing any other trooper, no.
Do you remember seeing a public safety technician that drove trooper vehicle?
No.
Okay. You never saw anyone else, any other public safety employee?
There was a, I forget what they call them, a VS or OP or the... I don't remember what they call them.
The VPSO or VPO?
Something, yeah, like that. Yeah, there was another.
Okay, it could have been, could be that and not a public safety tech, but some other public safety employee was there and had a vehicle.
I believe he drove a different vehicle. He didn't drive a trooper truck.
Okay. quick moment here.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
The affidavit that Judge Murphy swore to under penalty of perjury, that she only got one ride and it was after I was sentenced, is there any doubt whatsoever in your mind that that is a false affidavit?
Not.
Objection calls for speculation.
Overruled. You can answer that question.
I believe her statement was false. No doubt.
Based on personal observation.
Based on everything I saw, yes.
And that's all I have for you.
You messed up that. Run up to the witness stand, please.
Sir, if you'd remain standing and raise your right hand, you solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you'll give now before this court will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I do.
Thank you. You may be seated. And for the record, please state your name, spelling both first and last name.
My name is Drew Hiltebrand, first name D-R-E-W, last name Hiltebrand, H-I-L-T-E-R-B-R-A-N-D.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
Did you attend my sentencing in McGrath?
Yes.
Did it occur on 9/29/05 and go through the night into 9/30/05?
Yes.
Were you in the courthouse for every hour of that?
Yes.
Was I finally sentenced at nearly 1 a.m. on the 30th?
Yes.
Okay. Did you ever observe, before I was sentenced, Judge Murphy riding around with Trooper Gibbons?
Yes, I did.
How often did you see that?
Any time that, you know, I was outside the courthouse or saw them, that I actually saw them arrive or depart.
Okay. And so all of this happened before I was actually sentenced, or most of it, nearly all of it?
Yes.
Okay. Did you ever see Judge Murphy arrive or leave the courthouse alone or with anyone other than Trooper Gibbons?
Not that I recall, no.
And so just on a rough estimate, how many times did you see them traveling together?
That I can remember, three, maybe four times.
Okay.
I'm not sure exactly.
And that was just basically from the morning of the 29th to 1 a.m. on the 30th.
Yep.
Other than myself, has anyone ever contacted you about Trooper Gibbons giving Judge Murphy rides?
No.
In my case?
No.
Were you supposed to go to McGrath on November 9th to testify at my sentencing originally, November 9th, 2004?
Yes.
Okay. Did we fly you in from Silver Sam, a little village across the inlet from Silver Salmon to do so?
Yes.
And did we provide you transportation to Anchorage also?
Yes.
Okay. Did we ever, and was this for with the intent of going to McGrath?
Yes, that's my understanding.
Did we ever go to McGrath?
No.
And can you explain very clearly why that was?
We showed up at Brent Cole's office to go over some things. So David was going over some things with him, and basically, leaders. He had talked to leaders, and the deal that they had made previously was put off for whatever reason.
Okay, and was it? Did Mr. Cole? Was I angry?
Yes.
Was Mr. Cole angry?
More or less, I guess. Not angry, but resigned, I would say.
Okay. And did I ever ask Mr. Cole what could be done about this?
Yes.
And what did Mr. Cole say?
More or less, if I recall, he said that he could possibly talk to leader's boss, but not much that I recall. He said something to the effect that he had to work with them in the future.
Okay. And so is it true, did he say anything like, I can't do anything to piss leaders off?
That was more or less, yeah, the statement that he made, that he had to work with them in the future.
Okay. And so was it your impression that Mr. Leaders or Mr. Cole basically said, I can't do anything to get you your plea agreement because it'll affect my ability to work with the state in the future?
That would, yeah, the conclusion I would draw from that, yeah.
On the evening of November 9th, the day we were supposed to fly out to McGrath, what was the mood of everybody that was there? Were we ecstatic, happy, sad, angry? If you had to pick the gamut, the day that we were supposed to go out there, what was the mood of the people?
Disappointed, you know, perplexed, I guess.
Okay. Did you testify at my sentencing?
Yes, I did.
And the night before sentencing, were you given, did you know about written questions that were given to Chuck Robinson about the plea agreement?
Yes.
And was it your impression that Chuck Robinson was also going to ask questions about the plea agreement of Brent Cole?
I think so. He said he did. We went over some, yeah.
Okay. And did we went over, so it's your memory that we had written questions for Mr. Robinson?
Yeah.
About the plea agreement?
Yeah. I have a vague recollection of it, yeah.
Okay. Did Mr., as far as you know, and the court record will bear this out, did Mr. Robinson ever ask you the written questions about the plea agreement?
Not that I recall, no.
Okay. And just, did Brent Cole show up at my sentencing?
No.
Okay. And did you ever hear me ask Mr. Robinson what could be done about that?
I believe so.
But and do you
sure.
remember Mr. Robinson's response?
No, I don't really know.
Okay. That's all for, hang on here. Do you know if Mr. Robinson Were you with Mr. Robinson any time that you've seen Trooper Gibbons giving Judge Murphy rides?
I believe so, but it's been so long ago, I can't remember.
Okay, exactly. So it's possible, but yeah. You can't. Okay. That's all I have for you.
Hang on. Hey, Cross.
So, sir, you're a big game guide, right?
Yes.
Where do you guide?
Alaska Peninsula mostly, some on Kodiak.
Who do you guide for?
I'm sorry?
Who do you guide for?
I'm a registered guide, but I mostly guide for Frank Sanders, who's a friend of mine.
Okay. What's your relationship to Mr. Haig?
I met David 15, 16 years ago. I packed for him originally.
Okay. So you work? You packed for him.
Yeah.
And when you're a packer, to become an assistant guide, you first generally have to be a packer for, 2 years? Is that right?
Yeah, it's something like that, yeah. It's a certain number of days, but yeah.
And the registered guide that you work for has to write you a letter of recommendation to the board to get your assistant guide license then, right?
Right.
Mr. Haig wrote you that letter?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So he's responsible for your guiding career?
Yes, but that all happened before any of this happened.
Okay. And you've remained friends with him since then?
Yeah.
Did you ever guide for him as an assistant guide?
Yes, I did.
Around what time?
2000, early 2004, I think.
The spring bear season?
Yes.
Okay. He's a friend of yours?
Yeah.
Okay. You filed a sworn affidavit on July 19, 2010, in which you said that Trooper Gibbons was the primary witness against David Haig at sentencing and, I believe, at trial, right?
What's that? Yes.
Were you at the trial?
No, I was not.
Okay. Did you know that another friend of Mr. Haig, Mr. Zellers, actually was also charged along with him?
Yes.
And then made a deal with the state to testify against him at trial?
I recall him saying something about that, yeah, more or less. I don't know all the details, but yes.
Okay, so if you don't remember what happened at trial, what made you write in a sworn affidavit in 2010 that Trooper Gibbons was the primary witness against Mr. Haig at trial?
I was told he was the primary witness at trial.
Okay, so you swore out an affidavit. I declare under penalty of perjury the foregoing is true and correct based upon what someone told you?
Well, I mean, it should be a matter of court record, so yes.
But that's not what you just said. You didn't say it was a matter of court record and that you analyzed that. You said that someone told you that, right? Okay. You're nodding in affirmation. You're agreeing. Is that right?
I guess. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know.
Nothing further.
Is it true that in that affidavit you just said, I believe, you didn't know? You just said, based on the information that you had, you believe that Trooper Gibbons was primary
witness? I believe so, yes. Okay. I'd have to see a copy of it, but yes.
Okay, nothing further.
I have some questions. You went to the sentencing, right?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
Did you fly out there with Mr. Haig?
Yes.
How many people were with him, roughly?
Five or six.
Okay. And did those five or six all fly out together?
Yes, as much as I can recall.
Did you guys overnight?
Yes.
Stay at the same place? Aren't many options, I guess.
Yes, we did stay at the same place.
And were you around Mr. Haig during the sentencing process? I mean, it went on for whatever it was.
Yes.
You know, 15, 16 hours. Did you talk to him at breaks?
Yes, I'm sure we did.
Okay. And did you point out to him what you had observed about Judge Murphy?
I can't recall exactly. I couldn't say that we did. I think it was mentioned
amongst us. Was that something you were surprised about and, you know, they thought was noteworthy when you saw Murphy and the trooper together? Did that, you, that seem inappropriate to you?
It seemed unusual.
Okay. And so did you say to Chuck Robinson, hey, that's kind of weird. What do you think about it?
I don't recall that I specifically said something to him.
Did you say anything to David Haig about that?
I honestly can't recall.
Okay. Do you have any additional questions?
Nope.
You can sit down. Thank you.
Thank you.
Before the next witness comes in, there's something on the witness stand there. Not sure what it is, but it's been there for
some documents.
Mr. Zellers, I think.
Some document that you had provided somebody.
Yeah, I think it's the transcription of the meeting between Mr. Zellers.
You can retrieve it.
And can I admit it as evidence?
What is it?
It's the transcription of the meeting of Tony Zellers, prosecutor leaders, and Trooper Gibbons, in which Tony Zellers points out the map's false.
Is this already part of the record?
I believe it is, but I don't know, maybe this is.
Where'd you get it?
I objected when he asked if he could admit it as lacking in foundation, and also it's unclear where the transcript came from.
This is not an official transcript that was put in.
No.
Okay, no, you can't.
And I was going to ask you a question, Your Honor. You said you wanted the tape recording. I believe the state, we got this tape recording. This is something that confused me, is we got a tape recording of this meeting, and it cut off in mid-sentence. And for years, we thought that's all the state had. And finally, we got another, we kept hounding the state. We finally got another tape that has where they're talking about the map being falsified. And so we got that from the state. And I guess, can we give Your Honor that tape? I mean, you said you wanted the recording, whatever. We're not at our house where we have access to everything.
I don't. I'm lost.
Okay. You'd asked if I have a recording and I'm talking about the map being false before trial.
Is this your, do you claim that this is something that the prosecutor and the troopers recorded?
Yes.
Okay.
And then they gave us a copy of it later, many years after trial.
Many years after trial?
Yes. It should have been provided in discovery prior to trial, and only because we didn't get it, we didn't realize what had happened with the map until many years after. And so this is another reason why I believe there was a very bad discovery.
You raised this previously?
Yes.
In the earlier ineffective claim or the earlier appeal?
I don't know if we had this information during the appeal. I think we actually got this tape after my appeal was done, and it was sometime coming up through PCR when we obtained the tape.
Is it part of the PCR hearing in front of Bauman?
I believe I brought it up, and I wanted an evidentiary hearing, and I think he denied me having an evidentiary hearing on this evidence.
I will mark it, and it is not admitted as an exhibit, but it is part of the, it is kept so that you can show what you tried to get in, but it's not part of the record.
Okay.
So you mark that as an exhibit, but it's not admitted.
It's a court exhibit. And just as a point of clarification, for my own edification, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
What is this? It's a transcript that the petitioner created of a tape that they got, and this purports to be an exact copy of that tape. Is that
that's being...
Wait a minute. I thought you said that the transcript itself was created by the troopers and was given to you in discovery.
The recording was created by the troopers, the tape recording. We transcribed it when we got it.
Okay. So you got a partial recording... And then you got a full recording?
Correct.
And when did you get the partial recording?
I think that was maybe sometime a year or two, maybe three after trial. And then we listened to that and transcribed it, and it cut off in mid-sentence, you know, and there was, you know, so we knew there was more, and so we kept asking for years, where's the rest of it? And so then it was a number of years later we got the part that actually records the map being discussed as being false.
Does this transcript show where the first tape ended?
I can't answer that. I don't know.
And who made the transcript?
My wife.
Okay. So this is the objection that I have, Your Honor. Look, if they have a tape that shows something like this, then he could call a witness to establish that foundation. He's had a decade now to do that, hasn't done it. In fact, he's refused to do it, even though the Court of Appeals specifically told him to do it.
But
my objection to this is,
right,
we have no idea if it's accurate or not, and the problem with that, Your Honor, and I need to make this on the record, is that the clerk that looks at it, the Court of Appeals clerk that looks at it, may not recognize that it isn't, in fact, an authentic, you know, legal transcription of a verified audio. This could have been made up of whole cloth. We don't know. I'm not saying it was, we don't know.
I understand exactly what you're
saying. And that needs to be very clear. If it is a court, if it does come in as a court exhibit, then it needs to be branded in some way to reflect that.
Did not admit it as an exhibit.
No, as a court exhibit. Not. I understand that it's not being admitted as an exhibit for the purposes of this hearing, but
made your record.
For the record on appeal, it should be branded as such.
Who gave you the tape, the original one, the original recording? Who gave it to you?
The state of Alaska.
Do you acknowledge that? I'm not talking about.
I don't know anything about this specifically. It's not a matter that's before this court for the PCR, so I have nothing to say about it.
If you know the answer, tell me. If you don't know the answer, that's fine.
I don't know the answer.
Okay, that's good.
And if it would have been part of this hearing, then I would know the answer, but I haven't researched that.
It would be helpful for me if you had the tape, because I don't know what, you know, this transcript, who knows whether.
Okay, and what I'm saying is when we get home, I will make it my first thing I do to try to get this court, and if this, I assume the state has the recording.
I have no idea.
We got a copy from them, that's all I know. And so I can get you the audio.
Did you bring all that? Now, just, you asked this before, but I can't remember what you said. Did you bring this up in front of Bauman?
Yes.
And what happened down there?
I asked for an evidentiary hearing because we just found out this evidence, and he dismissed my request, and I think the same day or a day after ruled on my PCR, decided it, and said, deny my request for an evidentiary hearing, and then denied my PCR but overturned my sentence. And so I never have had an evidentiary hearing on... I never got this in other words. Although I asked in an official request, I said, lo and behold, you know, whatever it was, 13 years after my trial, we get a tape recording of the prosecutor and trooper and state witness talking about how their trial exhibit was false before trial, and then they still used it against me. That's where they talk about
the map. When do you think this thing was made?
The what?
The recording.
It was made exactly on the day of Mr. Zeller's meeting with Scott Leaders and Trooper Gibbons prior to my trial, and it may have a date on it. I don't know.
Okay. You can submit a copy of the partial recording and the full recording.
Okay, and it was made on 6/23/04, and there was a number on the tape. Would that help if I had... If you guys had the tape,
you seem to claim that there's two tapes, two recordings, one partial, one full.
Okay.
I'm going to give you an opportunity to.
So you want both tapes? You want the partial?
Yes, I do. You're making accusations that.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. The next witness is a Tom Stepnoski. He's in Pennsylvania, and he has a number here. We could try call if we could try calling it. Is that available?
Sure. What's the number?
570-960-4040.
was my name again?
Tom Stepnosky.
Thank you. This is Judge Melissa's clerk calling in regards to testifying in the David Haig versus State of Alaska case. Okay, hold on just a moment.
Mr. Stepnosky, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, sir.
My name is William Morse. I'm a Superior Court judge here in Anchorage. You're being called as a witness by David Haig in a case he has against the state of Alaska that arises out of his conviction. He is calling you as a witness. He'll be asking you questions first, and then the state's attorney, Mr. Peterson, may have some follow-up questions for you. So are you available for some testimony?
Yes, sir.
I'd like you to raise your right hand, and the clerk will swear you in.
Mr. Stepnosky?
Yes.
You solemnly swear or affirm the testimony you'll give now before this court will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I do.
Thank you. For the record, please state your name, spelling both first and last name.
Thomas Stepnosky. Thomas Stepnosky is Stepnosky.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Did you attend my sentencing in McGrath in, I believe it was 2005?
Yes, I did.
Okay, did my sentencing start on 9:29:05 and go into the early morning hours of 9:30:05?
Yes, it did.
Were you in the courthouse for all of this time?
Yes, I was.
During this period, did you ever see Judge Murphy ride around with Trooper Gibbons?
Yes, I did, multiple times.
Okay. And when you say multiple times, did they leave during the day, come back? I mean, can you explain what multiple times means?
Well, when we drove from where we were staying, she drove down with Trooper Gibbons. And then at the courthouse, when we went on breaks, Trooper Gibbons would give her a ride to the store for her to pick up soda and snacks and then drive her back multiple times.
Okay. Is it true I was sentenced at maybe midnight or 1 a.m. on the 30th?
I don't remember the exact time, but it was very late, yes.
Okay, and these rides that you've seen Judge Murphy getting from Trooper Gibbons, did they occur before I was sentenced or after?
Before. Multiple times.
Okay. Did you ever see Judge Murphy arrive or depart the courthouse alone or with anyone other than Trooper Gibbons?
No, I did not.
Were you ever contacted by anyone other than me about Trooper Gibbons riding with Judge Murphy?
No one contacted me, but I, on my own volition, contacted Marla Greenstein.
Okay. And what did you tell Miss Greenstein?
What I saw of Trooper Gibbons driving around, driving the judge.
Okay, and so if Marla Greenstein is recorded stating that you never seen that happening, that would be false, correct?
Completely false.
Okay. Were you ever with Mr. Robinson when you seen Judge Murphy riding around with Trooper Gibbons?
Yes, I was. I'm a smoker, and so was Mr. Robinson at the time, and we would be outside the courthouse smoking when Trooper Gibbons would give Judge Murphy a ride to the store for her to pick up soda and snacks.
Okay, so you're pretty sure that Mr. Robinson had to see the rides take place because you were with him?
Oh, he definitely had to see it. We were standing right next to each other. They would pull up in the truck, get out, and walk right by us back into the courthouse. Of course he's seen him.
Okay, and again, this was all before I was sentenced, correct? Or most of it?
It was all before you were sentenced.
Okay. And if Judge Murphy has sworn an affidavit that she only received a ride from Trooper Gibbons after I was sentenced, would that be a false affidavit from Judge Murphy?
That would definitely be false.
And how sure are you about that?
I am absolutely, positively.
Okay.
Know that that is a false statement by Judge Murphy.
Okay. And since it's a sworn statement, would you consider that perjury?
Yes, I certainly would.
Were you supposed to go out to McGrath on November 9th, 2004, for me to plea out?
Yes, I was.
Did we ever go to McGrath on November 9th?
No, we did not.
Can you explain very clearly and accurately why we didn't?
Because the district attorney changed everything that you were supposed to get. He told you one thing, and then when it came time to go out there, he completely changed everything.
Okay. Did I ever ask Mr. Cole what we could do about that?
Yes, you did.
And what did Mr. Cole say?
I can't do anything about that. I have to continue to work with the DA. I don't want to piss him off. The only thing I can do is call his superior and see what they say.
Okay. Were you ever with me personally when I talked to Mr. Robinson?
Yes, I was, many times.
Okay, did you ever hear Mr. Robinson state anything about his ability to enforce the plea agreement I'd made with Mr. Cole?
My recollection was he said he can't do anything that was water under the bridge.
Okay. Did you ever hear Mr. Robinson tell me anything about standing mute at trial?
Yes, I did. I heard him tell you not to say anything.
And was he also saying that he should stand mute also?
That I do not recollect.
Okay. Do you remember any of that coming up in the context of subject matter jurisdiction?
Yes, I remember that.
Okay. And did Mr. Robinson say if we put up a defense, it may admit or waive subject matter jurisdiction?
Correct. That's exactly what he said.
Okay. Did we stay with Judge Murphy at the McGrath B&B, or did you stay with Judge Murphy at the McGrath B&B?
Well, we stayed at the... Not with her, but we stayed in the same place, yes.
Okay. While you were there, did you ever see Trooper Gibbons eating with Judge Murphy where we were staying?
Yes, I did. They sat in the back of the little restaurant there at a table sitting alone.
Okay. Were you with Mr. Robinson when you seen this?
Yes, I was.
Okay.
Thank you.
Were you with Mr. Robinson? How often were you with Mr. Robinson when you seen Judge Murphy riding around with Trooper Gibbons?
Well, every break we got during at the courthouse, we would go outside and have a cigarette. And every time that we went out, Trooper Gibbons would give Judge Murphy a ride to the store for soda and snacks. So I would say in the course of the time period that we spent there during the day, I would say at least 6 to 8 times.
Okay. And do you remember Mr. Robinson? Do you remember me asking Mr. Robinson to ask questions about the year of guiding I gave up for the plea agreement that I didn't get?
You asked him that and other things, and he never asked any of those questions.
And do you remember the night before him agreeing to ask all those questions?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we were going over what questions were going to be asked the next day at the sentencing, and he never said a word.
Okay, and were those questions actually written out on paper?
That I do not recall.
Okay. Were you with me when I hired an attorney called Mark, or named Mark Osterman?
Yes, I was.
Do you remember us doing anything unusual with Mr. Osterman?
When you say unusual, as far as what?
By the time I hired Mr. Osterman, did we recognize we had a problem with Brent Cole and Chuck Robinson?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Okay, and
as a matter, Mr. Osterman made that statement.
Okay, what did Mr. Osterman say?
Well, that you've been sold out by your previous attorneys.
Hearsay.
Even if he's dead, how do I get around that? Or is it just gone forever?
Gone forever.
Is it true that because of the problems with Mr. Cole and Mr. Robinson, we tape recorded Mr. Osterman?
Yes.
Did you help in recording making those recordings?
Yes, I did.
As far as you could, as to your knowledge, is it true that I tape recorded everything?
I'm not sure as far as everything, but I know you made recordings.
Okay.
We made recordings.
Yeah, did you personally help make recordings of him?
Yes, I did.
Okay. That's all I have for you, Mr. Stepnoski.
All right, thank you.
Don't
hang up.
Don't hang up.
No.
Any cross?
Just very brief. So, Mr. Stepnoski, how do you know Mr. Haig?
I've been a friend of his for many years. I worked with his wife, and that's how I got to know him, and went out to his lodge, started doing some work out there, and eventually actually worked for him.
Okay. What capacity did you work for him?
I was the camp manager.
Okay. Did you like that job?
Yes, I loved it.
Okay. How long did you do that for?
I would have to say probably 5 years.
What were those years?
Pardon me?
What were those years?
I believe they were like from 2001 to 2005, or 2000 to 2005, somewhere in that range.
Okay. Would you have preferred to keep doing that, keep acting as his camp manager?
Oh, yes, definitely.
And so when Mr. Haig was charged, that sort of ended your work out there. Is that right?
Yes.
And you maintained your friendship with Mr. Haig throughout that?
Yes, I did. Still do.
You're close?
Pardon me?
You're close? Your close friends?
Oh, yes. I would consider us very close friends.
And in that capacity as his friend, you surreptitiously recorded an attorney without his knowledge?
Yes.
You said on direct that the district attorney changed the deal. Oh, how do you know that? Were you privy to the conversations between Mr. Cole and Mr. Leaders?
Between Mr. Cole and Mr. Leaders?
Yes.
No, but I was there when Mr. Cole told us that Mr. Leaders had changed the deal and we wouldn't be flying out to McGrath.
When he told you there was no deal and you wouldn't be flying out, you were there for that?
No,
you don't know what the
I didn't say that.
Right?
I didn't say there was no deal. I said Mr. Cole said Mr. Leaders changed the original deal to something else and we would not be flying out to McGrath.
You know what that original deal was then?
Well, all I can say is this. It was nowhere near what Mr. Hague wound up getting. The exact of it, I really don't remember offhand.
Okay.
But I know it was, instead of getting hit with a little ball peen hammer, he got hit with a sledgehammer.
Okay, nothing further.
Any other questions?
No.
Thank you, sir. You may hang up.
All right. Thank you.
Can I call myself?
Sure.
Can I stay here or do I have to go up there?
You can stay there.
Mr. Hagen, if you'd stand and raise your right hand. You solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you'll give now before this court will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I do.
Thank you. You may be seated. And for the record, please state your name, spelling both first and last name.
David Hague, DavidHaeg.
Thank you.
Mr. Hague, let me caution you. You have a brief period of time. You've got the five topics that I'm authorized to deal with. I know you have a lot to say. My recommendation to you is you focus on the five topics. Nonetheless, you can say whatever you want.
Okay.
But don't waste your opportunity.
Okay. I would just like to testify that I was present at my trial and sentencing every day, every hour, and flew out to McGrath. I think almost every time with Judge Murphy, every single time that I seen Judge Murphy, she got in a truck with Trooper Gibbons. We stayed with Judge Murphy at the McGrath B&B. While we were there, I personally witnessed them eating together. I pointed, when it first started happening, I pointed out to Chuck Robinson, and he said, hey, there's nothing I can do about it. It's the way it is in the villages. You know, get over it. Again, because McGrath's such a small place, we walked from where we stayed, or like Chuck said, sometimes we borrowed bicycles, little gravel road. Judge Murphy, Trooper Gibbons going by us all the time. You know, I seen them, I think I may already testify this, but I seen them eat together. Basically, they were together a very large portion of the time that we were out of court. And, you know, that was just what we could see. You know, behind closed doors, maybe there was more, but I don't know about that. At the courthouse, I personally never seen Judge Murphy arrive or leave alone or with anyone other than Trooper Gibbons throughout the whole amount of the trial and sentencing. And again, we rode with Judge Murphy on the same plane, and she would get on and off of the plane with, or get off the plane, get in with Trooper Gibbons. One of the items I'm allowed to litigate is whether Mr. Robinson gave me competent advice about the strength of my defense. He has admitted and testified that he told me that subject matter jurisdiction was the defense for me, and that we should depend on it to the exclusion of all else, and told me that in fact it's so strong that at trial both he and I should stand mute and never put up a defense. I was so scared that I contacted friends and relatives, including some of those that had friends that were lawyers, and ran this by them, and they were all with one word, horrified that any attorney would suggest that. And in fact, Mr. Robinson told me that should we try to put on a defense, that this would waive subject matter jurisdiction and thus ruin our defense. After I fired Mr. Robinson, I actually looked into what's subject matter jurisdiction. And let me just find the stuff I need here for a second.
Isn't it true, Mr. Haig, that he made the motion regarding subject matter jurisdiction?
What was that?
Isn't it true that he made the he raised that motion?
Correct.
Okay. And it got denied.
And
you appealed that.
Yeah, and he appealed that.
Okay. Second question. You didn't stand mute at trial, did you? You provided a variety of defenses.
What was that?
You provided a variety of defenses.
Yes.
Okay.
Where it would have went. Anyway,
you want a break?
What was that?
Do you want to break?
Just hang on one second here, please. I found it.
Sorry about that.
I got a lot of papers.
Because my career and my family's welfare depended on it, I started looking into what Mr. Robinson had said and why he based everything on subject matter jurisdiction.
But he didn't.
It's what he told me, and it was his appeal point. So I'm just...
Right, but I, okay. I know you...
Can I put on my defense,
yes, you
please,
can,
Your Honor?
But you can't make stuff up. You didn't stand mute.
I'm getting beyond that.
Okay. All right, good.
Okay. I started looking into what Mr. Robinson recommended I stand mute. And you're right, we didn't. But I wanted to check to see if he was telling me the truth. That because I very nearly said, let's stand mute. It was on a razor's edge. And so after... As Mr. Dalifka said, things
when
are confusing.
When did you decide not to stand mute?
I don't know, it was like the day of trial? Or
the day of trial.
Well, I mean, it was probably prior to that, but it was right up to, close to the day of trial. Okay, so I looked into subject matter jurisdiction, and I found that it is set by state statute. And I'm looking at a Cornell Law School definition of subject matter jurisdiction, and it says...
Cut to the chase.
Okay. It says that...
What is the point of this that you're trying to do? Because it
the,
sounds to me
the
like
point of it is, and it'd sure help if I could talk without being interrupted.
All right. Go for it.
It says, in state court systems, statutes that create different courts generally set boundaries on their subject matter jurisdiction. And so state statute sets subject matter jurisdiction. And Mr. Robinson said that if I brought up other defenses, it could waive subject matter jurisdiction. The definition in the Cornell Law School, it says, while litigating parties may waive personal jurisdiction, they cannot waive subject matter jurisdiction. So right there, I knew Mr. Robinson was telling me a falsehood. He told me that if we brought up other defenses, it would waive subject matter jurisdiction. And here it says from the Cornell Law School that it cannot be waived. And so I believe my attorney was lying to me. I kept looking into this.
Have you ever been wrong?
Yes, many times.
Were you lying when you were wrong?
Sometimes. Okay, so, okay.
I mean, is it possible someone can make a mistake without lying?
It is possible, yes. I'll agree with that.
You don't think it's possible that your lawyer made a mistake? You insist on believing he was lying?
Okay.
Well, I'm asking you.
There's so much proof that he was lying, it shocks me. Can I go over why I feel that way?
Well, I've been listening to a man who is exhibiting an enormous quantity of moral outrage, who thinks that he has been wronged. And the one question I've always wanted to ask you is, you lied when you described where you got the wolves and prepared those documents to the state, right?
Yes.
Where's the moral outrage there?
The moral outrage is the state official running the program told me to shoot the wolves where we did, and then he told me to claim that they were shot inside the area.
So
that's my moral outrage.
You lied, right?
Yes, but a state official that's running the program says the whole future of this program is at stake, and for it not to be shut down, they have to kill wolves, and since there's no wolves inside the area that's open, he says go outside the area and shoot wolves and claim they're taken on the inside so that artificially it look like the program is successful.
Why would you do that?
Because I believe the person telling me, he was the Ted Spraker, the guy running the program. He was a senior state of Alaska biologist, and he was running the wolf control program. And he said, David, this program is going to go down the tubes if you don't make it work. And here's what you need to do.
And you said yourself, what a great idea. I'll lie. Jeopardize my career and family.
I did not. I trusted him that was the proper thing to do.
Out of curiosity, did you raise this defense at trial?
I was told that it was an illegal defense, and I did not raise it because I was told specifically it was an illegal defense. And why I'm so outraged, and thank you for letting me get this out, the document that I put into the court record explained exactly what I was told by the state, and it's in the court record. It's like being with your clerk now. I can't go pull the court record out without her watching me. You know, once it's in the court record, it's kind of, the word is inviolate, I think, or whatever. And so my proof that the state told me this was removed out of the court record after it was admitted, and there's a cover letter that proves it was in there. And years after my wife found out it was missing, and I want this on the record. When I brought it up, the Court of Appeals, I said, I want to reconstruct the record. And here's this document. The state never even opposed. And because the cover letter says that it not only went to the court, but because everything that goes to the court has to be copied to the state prosecutor's office, they obviously got a copy of my evidence. So when I wanted to reconstruct the court record, they didn't oppose. So that led me to believe that they knew that evidence was originally in the court record and it had properly been copied to them. They never asked for another copy of the evidence. And so what happened is this happened with Brent Cole, and it never...
Did you get a copy of the letter back?
Huh?
Did you get a copy of the letter back?
No.
Did you
have We had one that we submitted, but we never knew where it went. And the problem, Your Honor, is that we...
Go ahead.
When I reconstructed the record, the state... We didn't get it done in time for my original appeal, and then it got into post-conviction relief. And this is where... When I realized Judge Murphy was running around with Trooper Gibbons, the cover letter said that it was received by the McGrath court and signed for. It's Margaret Murphy, M, I don't know what her middle initial is. But then the evidence is gone. And so when I filed the complaint of Judge Murphy riding around with Trooper Gibbons, part of that complaint that I put before the courts was I believe Judge Murphy went into the court record and removed it out because to favor Trooper Gibbons and to eliminate my defense. And that never really got litigated. It just kept, I would make these claims. There should have been an evidentiary hearing. There never was. And now we're, 15 years down the road. But the significance of that is there was evidence in the court record that is no longer there, that the trial court never seen or did see and took out so that it would, and that goes right along with the false map and my attorneys not telling me the truth. All of a sudden, right or wrong, I believe that everybody was against me, including my own attorneys and the judge and everybody. And then, like you heard testimony that nearly everybody here says that this affidavit from Judge Murphy, this sworn affidavit, is false. To have evidence like that, Your Honor, that a sitting judge has committed felony perjury is disturbing, not just to me, but to all these people that are here that want these courtrooms have to be, they have to have integrity. And, I mean, you should agree with that. If they don't have integrity, you don't have anything.
I agree with you.
Okay. That's why I'm, you know, in your office, the troopers here, whatever, I hope they listen to this, because if you lose, if the public loses faith in these courtrooms and courthouses and judges, we begin to act irrationally and wrongly. And, you know, the last time I was, not this last time, but, you know, a while back, I was tased in a courtroom solely for saying this map was falsified at trial, and this, or before trial, and there's evidence that the prosecutor and trooper knew this map was false, and they, knowing it was false, used it against me. And when I tried to bring that out, instead of somebody stepping back and saying, Mr. Hegg, hey, we'll give you an opportunity, they come at me with tasers and tase me, and because of that, I didn't get that opportunity. I'm glad I got it again. But what if I'd had a heart attack when I was tased and I died? That would never come in. And all this evidence that Judge Murphy is lying about what happened would never come out. And, you know, and I know I'm kind of going off the rails here somewhat with what you want me to do, but it is so important, Your Honor, it is so important that Marla Greenstein, something be done. Everybody tells me, this is a common refrain, and I'm sure it's yours, what Marla Greenstein did years after your conviction has no bearing on your conviction. Would you agree with that, Your Honor?
Correct.
Okay. Every single person here, if I asked them whether or not they would decide I got a fair trial or not, whether or not Marla Greenstein, whatever it was, 8 years after my trial, falsified an investigation to cover up what my trial judge did, I will guarantee you every one of those person would raise their hand and say that would help me decide that you didn't get a fair trial. So their opinion, the public's and mine, differs from yours, because the question is this: if something didn't go wrong at my trial, why did Marla Greenstein cover up what happened at my trial?
Anything else you want to say?
Yes, I do.
Then this is your opportunity.
Okay. I looked into subject matter jurisdiction. I found out it's set by state statute. I looked up to see if Alaska has such a statute. I found AS 22.15.060, criminal jurisdiction. It says the district court has jurisdiction of the following crimes, a misdemeanor. In other words, when I was charged in district court with a misdemeanor, the court had subject matter jurisdiction, and it makes zero difference, zero, what Mr. Leaders does in either swearing to or not swearing to a charging information. That is fact. So when Mr. Robinson said there was some defect, that is false. Okay, I won't say it's a lie. I'll just say that was false information. And for him to tell me to put all my eggs in one basket on this when it's now false, and he was touted as one of Alaska's top criminal defense attorneys, just like with what happens with Marla Greenstein, all of our hackles stick up, because my family and I, Your Honor, hired the best. We didn't hire in the bottom of the barrel. We went to the top of the barrel. And now my top of the barrel is telling me to rely on a defense that beyond a shadow of a doubt was invalid. And he has testified under oath that it was valid. And I know, and these people can go right on Google, Cornell Law School, and verify that. Mr. Robinson has testified that when I asked him what case law supported his belief that the subject matter jurisdiction was valid, he gave me two cases, U.S. Supreme Court cases. One of them was Albrecht versus United States, 1927. The other one that he gave me was Gersten versus Pugh, decided in 1975. Mr. Robinson told me that the prosecutor not swearing to the charging information deprived the court of subject matter jurisdiction, and that these cases prove that. And remember, Your Honor, this is very important, and you should take a note on this if you have a pencil or have the clerk do so, is I was never arrested. Brent Cole said it's time to go into court, and so under my own power, I went into court. And so I started looking through Albart versus United States. Down a ways, it says, as the affidavits on which the warrant issued had not been properly verified, the arrest was in violation of the clause in the Fourth Amendment, which declares no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation. But then it says, but it does not follow that because the arrest was illegal, the information was or became void. In other words, Mr. Robinson's case law that he gave me proved the exact opposite of what he told me they proved. Again, the hackles go up on the back of my neck. Again, I'm like, what is going on with a top criminal defense in this state telling me, again, that's a mistake, right? In your book, that's a mistake. Well, maybe it was a mistake that he said, you know, it couldn't be waived, or it could be waived when in fact it can't. That might be a mistake. But now he's made two massive mistakes. So then I keep looking through. And it says here, a little further down in Albright, it says the invalidity of the warrant is not comparable to the invalidity of the indictment. A person may not be punished for a crime without a formal and sufficient accusation, even if he voluntarily submits to the jurisdiction of the court. But a false arrest does not necessarily deprive the court of jurisdiction of the proceeding in which it was made. Where there was an appropriate accusation, either by indictment or information, and remember I was charged by information, a court may acquire jurisdiction over the person of the defendant by his voluntary appearance. And remember, I voluntarily appeared. And the distinction is, I just want to make this clear for everybody, these cases concern personal jurisdiction. The court has to have two kinds of jurisdiction, and I believe you know that, subject matter and personal. They have to have the, like here in this court, you know, in a district court, in my district court, if I'd have been charged with a felony, they would have not had subject matter jurisdiction because the statute says they're limited to misdemeanors. Personal jurisdiction is what both these cases are about, and it proves that what Mr. Robinson told me was a lie. And in fact, it says right here, here the court had jurisdiction of the subject matter, and the persons named as defendants were within the territorial jurisdiction. In other words, they're saying that the subject matter isn't what's being addressed in this case. It is the personal jurisdiction, the ability to arrest somebody. I'm going to go over Gersten versus Pugh. It says right here, the sole issue in this case is whether there is probable cause for detaining the arrested person pending further proceedings. I was never arrested. How can Mr. Robinson, who I've paid many tens of thousands of dollars to, say that this supports his notion that the court didn't have subject matter jurisdiction when it is solely about the issue of whether there's probable cause for detaining an arrested person pending further proceedings? And remember, again, I was never arrested. So why is he saying this proves my defense when it's all about being arrested? And it specifically says if you're not arrested, this doesn't apply anyway. So then I look through it a little more. I go, "Uh, In holding that the prosecutor's assessment of probable cause is not sufficient alone to justify restraint of liberty pending trial, and I was never restrained, it says, we do not imply that the accused is entitled to judicial oversight or review of the decision to prosecute. In other words, the prosecutor can write up an information, sign it, and it is completely valid for a charging document. He doesn't have to provide anything with it. That's one of the issues I have, is that maybe Mr. Robinson made a mistake in the first instance when he told me those cases proved that the court didn't have jurisdiction over me. They proved the exact opposite, and it's clear for anybody. Something else, I believe we proved in this case that my statement and the charging information bear this out, and I would like to have Your Honor actually ask the state's attorney.
Keep speaking.
Huh?
Keep talking.
Okay. Is if my statement made during plea negotiations was ever taken out of the charging information. In other words, the charging information that forced me to trial, did it still include my statement made during plea negotiations? It did, Your Honor, and Chuck Robinson protested it to Scott Leaders, certified that it got to Scott Leaders. Actually, I told, it came out that it came out in two ways. It actually went to Mr. Leaders in three ways. Mr. Robinson's staff certified that they hand-delivered it, couriered it over to Mr. Leaders' office, that they faxed it to his office, but then they found out Mr. Leaders was attending a district attorney conference at the Alyeska Ski Resort. And they wrote a letter there, or a fax document, and faxed it to there. And in the fax document, it says, here's Dave Hegg's affidavit protesting your use of his statement in a charging information, sending him to trial. And they, on the cover letter, it says, you know, Alyeska Ski Resort staff, give this to District Attorney Leaders ASAP. So when Mr. Leaders, when I filed a bar complaint in a certified document, when he said, I never used Mr. Hegg's statement in the charging information, we know that's true. The charging information's prove it. I mean, it's just, it says Dave Hegg came in, said this, this, and this, and this is why we're charging with this, this, and this. I mean, it's all over in it. Your Honor should look at that. Not only that, is Mr. Leaders then says in the certified document, the proof that I did not use Mr. Hegg's statement, the proof is nobody complained about it. This certified document, Your Honor, was made after Robinson's staff certified informing Scott Leaders in three different ways. I believe that means that Prosecutor Leaders, to cover up, he gave me an illegal trial based on an information that wasn't worth the papers written on because it violated my right against self-incrimination, plain and simple, including Evidence Rule 410, that to keep me convicted, he was willing to falsify a certified document, which I believe is perjury. He was willing to commit a felony to cover up that I had a unconstitutional trial. I want to read Evidence Rule 410, which is what Scott Leaders, or what Arthur Robinson protested was violated by Scott Leader's use of my plea agreement statements to charge me with crimes to force me to a jury trial. Remember, if Your Honor remembers, I never pled out. I had a jury trial. Do we all agree on that? Okay, so here we go. Evidence Rule 410, inadmissibility of plea discussions in other proceedings. Statements or agreements made in connection with any of the foregoing pleas or offers is not admissible in any civil or criminal action, case, or proceeding against the accused person who made the plea offer if, there has to be one condition, a plea discussion did not result in a plea of guilty. I never pled out. How can my statement be used against me to force me to trial? Then, even worse, we've seen a lot of people testify about this map. Well, it is proven beyond any doubt whatsoever that I put these marks on this map. The state itself recorded me putting them on during my plea negotiation statement. They then show this map to Mr. Zellers, and they say, Dave Head put these marks on there. Can you confirm them and write, you know, some numbers down? So he does so. Then at trial, if I can find my trial book. I'm sorry, I'm kind of disorganized. Trial, Mr. Scott Leaders, and this is the official transcript from my trial on page 281. Mr. Leaders says, this is a map Trooper Gibbons has said. And then he says, you are the one that did this, right? Or one that right did this. Trooper Gibbons responds, yes. Mr. Leaders says, and he did trying to fairly depict the boundaries of the permit area. And then it was used in an interview, one with Mr. Hegg. So they're talking about this, and we have yet to identify that this is 25, which is not admissible because it was based on plea negotiations and also with Mr. Zellers regarding where the wolves were taken. And remember, we have a recording or transcription and a recording of Mr. Zellers and the prosecutor and trooper talking about how I put the locations on this map and how Tony Zellers confirmed them. So now they're talking about this map that was used in my plea negotiation statement. We go down page 28 or 281. You just kind of zip there, keep talking about different stuff, but they still kind of talking about this map. And then they say on 286, they said, Mr. Lee says, okay, I can mark it as an exhibit. That way, well, then we'll have a stipulation, I think, on that exhibit 25. And if you look at this, it says right here, plain as day, prosecution exhibit 25, admitted. In other words, there's zero doubt that not only was my statement used incorrectly, illegally, unconstitutionally, to force me to trial, at my very trial, they gave my jury my statement in violation of my right against self-incrimination. And what's even worse is not only was this map wrong with that, Scott Leaders, Trooper Gibbons and Tony Zellers, before trial, are talking about how the game management unit boundary had been falsified to prove I was killing the wolves inside my guide area to benefit my guide business. And I'll tell everyone here, including all these people, the state's whole case against me to my jury was Mr. Haig is killing the wolves in his guide area to benefit his guide business. Let's lay the hammer to him. Everyone there knew this was a lie. Not only that, Trooper Gibbons got up on the stand, put his right hand in the air, and he swore under oath those wolves were killed in my guide area 19C. Yet there's a recording prior to trial of him talking, and remember, Scott Leaders, the prosecutor, accepted this. So not only did Trooper Gibbons know he was committing perjury, and that's the word it is, perjury. Prosecutor Leaders was doing what's called suborning perjury. He was letting it happen while knowing it's perjury. So Mr. Leaders is also guilty of a felony there. They were guilty of two felonies when they falsified the map. Now they're guilty of two more. Let me think for just a minute here. Oh, something else that is interesting is that later on down the line here, Trooper Gibbons says it's he that put the wolf kill locations on this map. When there's a recording of him telling me to, Mr. Haig, can you take a pen and in ink place the wolf kill locations on here? Now, because they know that using my statement would mean I had an illegal trial, he's willing to lie again under oath in my trial that he put them on there. So now we're up to, how many felonies is that now? I'm starting to lose count. 5, 6, 7? I'll try to find the page where Trooper Gibbons says that. Oh, right here. Page 333. Mr. Robinson says this is. Mr. Leader says Exhibit 25. Mr. Robinson, Exhibit 25. The court, this is Exhibit 25. Let me check again here. Yep, Exhibit 25. Officer, first of all, I'm going to show you what's marked as Exhibit 25, and I want to see if you recognize that. Answer from Gibbons, yes, I do. Question, and what is that? Answer, that's an aircraft sectional for the McGrath area. And guess what this is? It's an aircraft sectional. It says right here, McGrath sectional aeronautical chart. And then Mr. Gibbons says, marked with marks and a legend placed on it by myself. Well, there's a recording that Mr. Gibbons made himself of him telling me to put the marks on this map. And I'll try to hold myself down and I'll be calm. But I am so angry. 15 years of my life went down the tubes. I was the youngest master guide in this state, professional pilot, and the state of Alaska asked for my help, and I was honored. Your Honor, I was honored that they asked me for my help. And I went out and I did a job for them, and I did exactly what they asked, and then they ripped me and my family apart from one end to the other, and they used my attorneys as double agents to do it. And when a grand jury looks into this, and a grand jury there will be, because these people are going to make sure there's a grand jury investigation into this, because our court system, the integrity is compromised, period. Marla Greenstein, who falsified my complaint of Judge Murphy and then lied in a certified document to cover up what she did, she has been the sole investigator of judges in this state for the past 30 years.
one judge investigator for the past 30 years. I want everybody to think about that. For 30 years, I talk to Ms. Greenstein. She gets, I don't know, it's like 15 or 20 complaints against judges a month. You multiply that by 12 months, and then you multiply that by 30 years, and the harm that that single person could have done to Alaska's judicial system is incomprehensible. And as much as I would like to say, hey, Your Honor, overturn my conviction, let me go, the real issue here is the integrity of Alaska's judicial system. My attorney that I hired lying to me about basic things, he was running me down a rat hole so I would never start looking into this. Marla Greenstein covered up what Judge Murphy did. And because of that, the word's starting to spread and our judicial system in Alaska is losing credibility and faith from the people. And if we let that happen, Your Honor, we don't have hardly anything. I mean, I hope you agree with that. If we the people lose faith in you people, what in reality, what do we have? We have anarchy. When we come in here, we need to believe that you're going to do the right thing and you're going to follow these rules that are there for a reason. It's because people fought and died for them. And you have the power to put me in jail, to tase me, to take away my airplane and my career. And if you're doing it illegally and by trumping up charges and trying to cover it up, you are going to have a rebellion that no one can stop. And if you doubt that, you wait another couple years if no one does anything, and there will be hell to pay. I found something online that I'm going to read because when I read it, I know exactly what we're dealing with here in the state of Alaska. And I want everybody to think about these errors that I brought up, how one of the best attorneys in the state could make such a unbelievable error. Tell me that the holy grail of my defense is something that is no good, 100%. How the prosecutor and troopers could get away with falsifying a map and not be found out. And by the way, I don't know if I went over this. Arthur Robinson filed a written discovery request for this map and the recording of them talking about falsifying it. Does anyone here actually believe that was a mistake by Mr. Leaders to not provide this map and that recording prior to trial? Because those two things together would prove they had committed felony tampering with evidence and that they were going to commit perjury and subornation of perjury. Does anybody here think that that prosecutor, Scott Leaders, the sole thing on his mind is we can't give this to Mr. Robinson or Mr. Haig or they'll find out what we're doing? Right here. This is the independent Mullen Commission report on corruption. It was in New York City. This report was made on 7/7 of 94. It says, what we found is that the problem of police corruption extends far beyond the corrupt cop. It is a multifaceted problem that has flourished because of a culture that exalts loyalty over integrity. Because of the silence of honest officers who fear the consequences of quote-unquote ratting out another cop, no matter how grave the crime. because of willfully blind supervisors who fear the consequences of a corruption scandal more than the corruption itself, because of the demise of the principle of accountability that makes all commanders responsible for fighting corruption. All these factors contributed to the state of corruption we uncovered. To cover up their corruption, officers created even more. They falsified official reports and perjured themselves to conceal their misdeeds. I want everybody right now to stop and think of this. What did Scott Leaders and Marla Greenstein do when I filed bar complaints about them? They falsified official documents and perjured themselves to cover up what happened to me. This report confirms that this is what happens in a what's called systemic corruption society. It means that many people are in on it and covering up for the others. It says, thus police corruption has become more serious and threatening than ever before. In the face of this problem, the department allowed its systems for fighting corruption virtually to collapse. It had become more concerned about the bad publicity that corruption disclosures generate than the devastating consequences of corruption itself. As a result, its corruption controls minimized, ignored, and at times concealed corruption rather than rooting it out. I want everybody here to remember Marla Greenstein, who stated that she contacted all five witnesses that I gave her to the corruption of a sitting judge, and Marla said she contacted all five of them. She was covering it up rather than rooting it out. She should have went right to Judge Murphy and said, Judge Murphy, you were riding around with a main witness in a case you're presiding over. We are going to have to remove you as a judge. That didn't happen. Instead, Marla covers up, says, oh, the witnesses didn't see anything. Then, what does Judge Murphy do? Rather than admit it happened, what does she do? She files a sworn affidavit that the rides never took place. Now, Your Honor, now not only do we have lawyers and prosecutors and troopers committing perjury, we have a sitting judge committing perjury. I will see Judge Murphy stand trial or investigated, or I'll die trying. I will see Marla Greenstein investigated and stand trial or die trying. Because before this happened, I had no idea what our Constitution meant. But now I understand totally what it means. It is our protection from you, 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 and you, and you. It is our only protection against you guys banding it together and coming and arresting me and taking my airplane. And how did they do it? By lying and cheating and stealing. And in essence, they stole my airplane. They stole my livelihood. They stole my life. Okay. I'm going to go on here. Such institutional reluctance to uncover corruption is not surprising. No institution wants its reputation tainted, especially a department that needs the public's confidence and partnership to be effective. That's exactly what this court system is losing. They're losing the public's confidence in it. And I pointed out why. Since no entity outside the department was responsible for reviewing the department's success in policing itself, years of self-protection continued unabated until this commission commenced its independent inquiries. I want to stop here. I found out in this state, that we do have an independent an entity outside the department. That entity in this state, Your Honor, is called the grand jury. A grand juror in Kenai tried to look into this evidence, this very exact evidence, as an entity outside the department to look into this stuff. Scott Leaders, the person who falsified this map and then falsified a certified document to cover up what he had done, he is the very person that ordered the grand jury to not investigate. You talk about scary, that when our independent entity, the grand jury, wanted to look into the stuff I've presented, that grand jury was shut down in the face of a statute that says this: if an individual grand juror knows or has reason to believe that a crime has been committed that is trialable by the court, that juror shall inform the other grand jurors, who shall investigate. This was a crime by a district attorney and a trooper. We also have proof that a sitting judge committed perjury. That grand juror was ordered not to present his evidence and reasons to believe to the other grand jurors. There's an Alaska statute that says he is obligated to do that. But no, the very person they were going to investigate, Scott Leaders, runs into the grand jury room and drags the grand juror out of the grand jury room into a locked courtroom where the public was not allowed to witness, and a sitting judge ordered him not to present his evidence to the other grand jurors. You talk about a problem. I'll continue here. This abandonment of effective anti-corruption efforts did more than avoid public exposure of corruption. It fueled it. It sent a message through the department that integrity was not a high priority and that the department bosses did not really want to know about the corruption. In short, it gave everyone in the department an excuse for doing what was easiest, shutting their eyes to the corruption around them. That's what's been happening in my case, wave after wave. That's why Mr. Dolifka is sitting there not even knowing how to testify, because it is so extensive, the corruption, he doesn't even know where to begin. We did go to the FBI, and Mr. Dolifka was actually called to the FBI a second day to testify about all the other cases in which he knew there was corruption. There's a serious problem when the FBI calls you back for another day to testify about all the other cases. And that is precisely what happened. The principle of command accountability, which holds commanders responsible for fighting corruption, completely collapsed. Supervisors and commanding officers were largely complacent about maintaining integrity. Few were concerned with corruption on their watch, unless it exploded into an embarrassing corruption scandal. And I predict, I'm going to ask every one of these people that after this hearing's done, we're going to walk right over to the governor's office, and I'm going to hand them this petition here. Actually, I don't know if I have it with me. Yeah, this is it here. There's about 500 signatures here, Your Honor. And you know what? We would have at least 10 times this, but you know what the people manning the booth at the Alaska State Fair said? They said the single most common thing they hear is, if we sign this petition asking for a grand jury investigation of the troopers and Your Honor and the prosecutors, they'll come after us. They'll have our name, they'll have our address, they'll have our phone number. Now, when you have the public, Your Honor, refusing to ask to investigate Your Honor because they're afraid of retaliation, do we live in a free country? Or do we live in a police state? Can you answer that?
Can you wrap up, please?
There's one item that I want to, right here. There's actually two more. One is, long time after my conviction, we got another tape recording. The tape from the state is hashtag 4MC-304-24. and it was a tape recording of Trooper Gibbons and one of the witnesses on the witness list in my trial. It captures Trooper Gibbons talking to him. Trooper Gibbons states...
Objection, hearsay.
What is this?
It's a tape that the state provided us of Trooper Gibbons interviewing a witness.
Prior to trial?
I believe so. Can I read it?
Right.
Huh?
Go ahead and read it.
Okay. Trooper Gibbons states, what are your concerns with regards to people who are issued predator control permits to participate in this wolf control project, and they kill wolves outside the wolf control area? What are your thoughts about that, and what effects it could have on the project? And Mr. Egrass replies, I was told by yourself, Officer Gibbons, the sensitivity this goes all the way up to the governor. The governor is putting himself on the line politically. And then Trooper Gibbons replies, yeah, I would hate to see any ammunition given to the animal rights groups that could potentially be used in the fight to get these programs shut down. And so I believe the motive behind the state to do all this to me was to cover up that a state official told me to shoot wolves outside of the open area and claim they were killed on the inside. And I had to do that to artificially show that it was effective. The program was, the animal rights activists were trying to shut the program down as ineffective. And so what the state wanted to do is make it seem effective by killing wolves elsewhere, but claiming they were in the program. And that was, and
you went along with that?
Yes. They told me what they wanted, and I did what I was asked.
And what does that suggest to you?
What was that? I missed that.
What does that suggest to you about your integrity?
Because they said we need this program to be successful so that ungulates, and ungulates are moose and caribou.
I know what they are.
Levels can be high enough to provide for the nutritional needs of remote villages. You need to do this. And so my integrity was, as I was doing this, so that people who needed the meat would have it.
Right, but you lied in order to gain that goal, correct?
Correct.
And now you're upset that other people are lying to obtain other goals?
I had a valid belief that what I was told by the state was right to do.
And you think that gave you permission to lie?
I was told to lie by the state. And when the state tells you to do it...
You could have said no, thank you. You could have said, no, I'm an honest man, I will not lie. But you said no.
Okay, you're right.
I will lie.
Guilty as charged, Your Honor. I want Scott Leaders to come up and say guilty as charged on a felony of tampering with evidence to frame me for... Okay. One other thing is... The state told me a long time ago, 6-512, they said the state has also identified one of the witnesses not previously identified.
What is this?
It was a state attorney.
In the state of Alaska?
Respondent, state of Alaska, by and through its counsel, Assistant Attorney General Andrew Peterson.
Mr. Haig, slow down. Mr. Peterson, I'm not sure that you get to ask him questions in this context, all right? Could you explain to me what it is you're talking about? What is this document?
It is I had asked for a discovery request of what the state was going to, what witnesses and evidence they were going to put on.
What is it that you've got in your hand?
It is a copy of the state's filing. It is a copy of their response to my 6-512 interrogatory discovery request.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And so in it, the state says, the state has also identified one new witness not previously identified prior to trial that the state intends to call if an evidentiary hearing is conducted in this matter. And I think this is an evidentiary hearing conducted in this matter. The witness's name is Bobby Fithian. Mr. Fithian is currently writing a letter to the state outlining the testimony he will give if called in an evidentiary hearing. The state anticipates that Mr. Fithian will testify that he spoke with Haig prior to Haig taking wolves outside the predator control area and warned Haig that he should not fly outside the area to kill wolves, but that it was Haig's intent to kill wolves outside the control boundary. Well, after I got this from the state, I got on the phone with Mr. Fithian and I tape recorded the call. And I says, Mr. Fithian, the state has falsified direct evidence and testimony to convict me of killing wolves in my guide area. And I asked him, why would you be willing to lie under oath during this evidentiary hearing? And I assume that was, I was looking for Mr. Fithian here because they said they're going to bring him in here. Mr. Fithian said, I am willing to lie under oath because the state put too much time and effort into the wolf control program to see your case end it.
Objection, hearsay.
Well, that's exactly what you guys did here, isn't it, where you say, Mr. Fithian.
Hey, wrap up.
Okay. Anyway.
Your time is up.
Okay.
Just sit down for a second. Let's talk about where we go from here, okay? Do you want some opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Haig?
I could use a couple of minutes.
Okay, so let's assume that we do that. Do either of you want some opportunity to file additional briefing based on the 2 days of testimony?
Can I have some time to think about it? My brain's been spinning for the last couple of days.
Okay. How much time do you want
an opportunity, the tape recordings that you...
How much time do you need to make a decision about what you want to do?
I would say, I don't know, is a week appropriate or less than that?
You tell me how much time it will take you to unwind so that you can make a rational decision.
A week?
What's today? So today's the 29th. A week from now is February 5. So by February 5, each of you tell me what you want to do, if anything, regarding further submissions. I'm not talking about new evidence. I'm talking about dealing with the evidence that has been developed in the last 2 days. Okay?
And you said February 15th?
February 5.
February 5.
A week today. You want to cross now?
Yes, I'll keep it brief. And I can also state for the record now that I think the record is clear. I don't think there's any need for any additional briefing from the state.
Okay. So you don't have to do that. If he does something and I allow him, you can reply to it, but you don't have to do anything initially. Okay. So ask your questions.
All right. So, Mr. Haig, you testified at trial in your defense, right?
Yes.
And at that trial, you admitted that you killed wolves outside of the wolf control area, right?
Yes.
And you were a registered big game guide at that time, right?
Yes.
And you knew that a guide committing a same-day airborne violation carried a guide license suspension of 3 years to a permanent revocation, right? Or did you not know that?
At that time, I did not know that.
At that time, you're talking about at the time of the wolf kill, or...
That was the question.
Okay, all right, go ahead.
At the time that you submitted the coordinates for where the wolves were killed, you gave false coordinates, thereby falsifying the sealing certificates, correct?
Yes.
Okay. You stated multiple times in open court that you were sentenced to 2 years in jail and a $20,000 fine. What was your actual imposed sentence in this case?
I don't know on the fine. You know, that got stayed.
$6,000?
I don't know. There was, I think it was $19,500.
And how much of that was suspended?
I don't remember.
All but $6,000, right?
I don't remember.
Okay. And you got 35 days to serve, right?
I believe so. It was over a month.
Where did you serve that?
Huh?
Where did you serve that?
In-home confinement.
Okay. So you served it on ankle monitor?
Yes.
Not 2 years in jail and $20,000 fine. You had to sit at home for a month and got a $6,000 fine. That was your sentence, right?
I was sentenced to nearly 2 years in jail and a $19,000 fine. $19,500 fine.
5 days were suspended, right? You never. How much time did you serve on home confinement?
The whole time.
35 days, right?
I believe that's accurate.
Not 2 years, right? So when you stand up in open court and say that you went to jail for 2 years, is that accurate?
I said I was sentenced to 2 years in jail.
Okay. I'm sorry. When you stand up in open court and say you were sentenced to 2 years in jail, is that accurate?
Yes.
It is.
Very nearly 2 years in jail, yes.
Even though you only did 35 days on home confinement.
The sentence says...
Mm-hmm. It does. It says 2 years with all but 35 days suspended, which would only be imposed if you violated your probation conditions, right?
I believe that's probably what it says.
Okay. Yes. All right. Your guide license was revoked for 5 years at sentencing, right?
Yes.
And the range was 3 years to a permanent revocation, right?
I believe that is so, yes.
So what you were actually sentenced to was at the extreme low end of the potential sentence as far as the guide license suspension goes, right?
Well, wouldn't you say 3 years would be less than the five?
It would be less. I didn't say the least available. I said at the extreme low end.
It's true.
Okay.
I would like.
When did you get your guide license back?
I'd also like to
add. When did you get your guide license back?
Answer his question.
Can I? Huh?
Answer his question.
It was like, and I'm not positive on this, but a year to 2 years after my suspension was over, because the state of Alaska told me after the suspension was over that they would never give my guide license back.
You got it back in 2011, right?
I don't know.
Around 2011?
It could be.
So it wasn't revoked for life. You were able to guide. Is that right?
Yeah.
So
I ended up getting my guide license back, yes.
Okay.
I would like it on the record, however, that after my 5-year suspension was over, Your Honor, the state refused to give me my guide license back. And in my...
When did you get it back?
I don't know the exact year. All I know
best
is...
Best recollection. Help me out. What's your best recollection?
Well, if it was 2005, there have been 5 years on top of that, so it would be 2010. And then when they didn't give it back in 2010, I had to fight for another couple years. So it was like 2012.
But any idea when? Spring? Fall?
I don't. You know, and I could find that out if it's important.
You don't remember? You don't remember.
Yeah.
But sometime in 2012 is when you think it came back.
And what?
Just
I guess,
answer my question. Yeah. Sometime basically in 2012 is your best recollection?
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. You have further questions?
No, Your Honor.
All right, so you submit your thing in February 5 about what you want to do, okay?
Okay.
And these various documents, the ones that are admitted as exhibits and the others that are just marked for identification, will be part of the court file. All right. We'll be in recess.
Please rise. Court is adjourned.